Live from New York City, it's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null, broadcasting and video streaming live from our studios in New York City, and I welcome you. If you'd like to watch today's show, you can go to ustream.tv and search for Gary Null. That's ustream.tv. ustream.tv and search. Today, the latest on what happens when you don't get a good night's sleep, something we never considered, but we've all seen it. Also, there's a nutrient that's very important for detoxifying your body. It's called glutathione. More in-depth on why you should pay attention to it, get it into your system, what it does. Also today, we're going to look at the dangers of meat. A new Harvard study shows you could be adding years onto your life if you get rid of all that processed meat. Also, optimists are much better at regulating stressful events. And research confirms that sweating is a major form of cleansing and detoxing. In order to give you a better understanding of what it means when I'm out traveling the heartlands of America, filming, interviewing people for the many documentaries I do, I'm going to give you a bird's eye view of the climate change that's driving the Southwest towards a disaster. Not just temporarily, permanently, where it will not be sustainable in any of our lifetimes. Sasha Abramsky from The Nation, an important insight. I'll be sharing my commentary on my views, because it makes a whole lot of difference when you're in New York or the suburbs, you're out Long Island, and you don't see any effects of drought. You don't see effective food shortages. You can go to supermarkets and have more selection than you would possibly be able to consume. But what happens when you drive up to a farm or a ranch or a homestead and you see a family with weathered faces and hands and necks from being out in the sun and the climate year in and year out? And generation after generation, they had assumed that they would continue. And now they can't because of the water's gone or it's so low, it can't irrigate enough of the crops. It can't irrigate the grass that their cattle need to eat. And it can't irrigate their vegetable gardens. So what do you do? Well, it's a sad story. But they try to sell their property, but it's too late. What good does it do to buy a 1,000-acre ranch that has beautiful views, that is gorgeous in the sunrise and sunset, but you couldn't grow anything? You couldn't live there. The wells are dry. Where are you going to get your water? How would you support yourself? This is happening every minute of every day in the United States, and not a single report on it in any of the mainstream media. We'll go in depth on that today. My guest in the second part of our program is going to resolve some issues that we have not discussed, I haven't heard discussed on any of the programs, and that is our current form of capitalism, our free market expression, is it the underlying cause of violent, inherently violent genocide? My guess says yes. My guess says that over 10 million people die each year needlessly because of our free market efforts. That's massive genocide. That's more than at any time during the Second World War, who was how many people died in a given year. And yet we're killing that many every year. So he says, Professor Gary Leach, Director of the Center for International Studies and Professor, Department of Political Science and at Cape Breton University in Nova Scotia. So he'll be on the phone from Nova Scotia. We'll discuss this. I want to give you an opportunity to hear about coincidences. as a investigative reporter, breaking important stories, over 300, I always look to see, is this casual, is this causal? Is this just a coincidence? And then I start to peel back the layers to see what I find. What you're going to hear today in a 15-minute clip about 9/11, at the very least, will raise questions. Questions that no one in the official government positions in mainstream media has been willing to ask. Now, mind you, these are all pieces of a puzzle. They're all speculative. The information given is completely accurate and fully documented. The conclusions are that what did all the people, or at least not all the people, what did the people mentioned have in common on the morning of 9/11? You haven't heard this before. You haven't seen this. This will be a mind opener. Let's begin. We have a lot to share today. First up, a new Harvard study shows that reducing red meat consumption can extend your life by 20%. That could be 20 years for a lot of people, 15 years for many, and for the average American, about 10 years. That's a big deal. In the Archives of Internal Medicine, a new article, 84,000 women, 38,000 men, their diets were analyzed, and they looked at those big juicy steaks several times a week. Here's what they found, quote, unequivocal, people who ate the most red meat, especially processed red meats, died younger, and most often from cardiovascular diseases and cancer. Quote, from the study, we estimated that substitutions of one serving per day of other foods, including fish, poultry, nuts, legumes, low-fat dairy, and whole grains, for one serving per day of red meat were associated with a 19% lower death rate. We also estimated that 9.3% of deaths in men and 7.6% in women, these cohorts could be prevented at the end of follow-up if all the individuals consume fewer than 0.5 servings a day. That's approximately 42 grams, or it's approximately about 1 ounce of red meat, end quote. So that's a lot. Quote, this is from the Harvard School of Public Health from a Dr. Frank Hu. This study provides clear evidence that regular consumption of red meat, especially processed meat, contributes substantially to premature death. If someone is age 60 and has a 50% chance of dying in the next 25 years, adding one serving a day would increase his risk of dying in that time to about 57%. If he had two servings a day, this would be about 63% risk of dying in that time. End quote. Well, how much meat does the average American eat? Well, here's how it works. If you eat meat, it's for a reason. You eat meat because, like all of us, myself included, we were led to believe that you needed to have the basic four food group. Our mothers prepared breakfast, lunch, and dinner based on that concept. So where I grew up, people ate meat three times a day, the largest portion being at dinner. Roast beef, sometimes chicken. But people where I grew up, baby boomers, our parents came through the Great Depression. They had massive privations. My mother said that it was rare that they ever ate chicken. They sometimes would eat fish, but only if it was caught in the river. That would be the Ohio River or the Little Kanawha River. They didn't eat meat because my great aunt was a vegetarian, and she was extremely strong and wiry, vigorous, disciplinarian, which scared everyone. No one wanted to be around a disciplinarian where I grew up, and I liked her. I thought she had the coolest place in the world out there in the country because she had everything by categorization. So she had an herb garden with hundreds of different herbs. And then she had a cheese house. We went in the house, and it was about 8 feet below ground. It was all done in stone. And hanging were all these cheeses, and she would have them dipped in wax, beeswax, And then she put a date on them what the cheese was. And they could last for years that way. Because once you're below ground, if you're in a root cellar, they stay about 55 degrees 12 months a year. And that's how people originally had some form of refrigeration or storage. Apples, root vegetables can stay up to a year that way. But also she would keep her root vegetables in the ground. Now, I had never heard of this before. In fact, not until I had my own organic farm upstate in Stone Ridge at the Fertiller Farm did I realize you did not have to harvest things the way we've been told. So you could go out at any time, 12 months a year, and pull a carrot out of the ground. I mean, everyone always thought that you had to have everything harvested all at once, peaches or acorns, whatever they were. Not true. In fact, to prove my point, I made a little box. The box was about, it was about 4 feet by 4 feet by 1 foot. And in that box, I filled it up with about 12 inches of good quality soil. And I would fertilize it about once every 3 weeks. In there, I decided to do a test. So I put red dip lettuce. And as it grew, I would cut one leaf off of each head. But I grew them very intensely, meaning they, instead of 8 inches apart, they were 3 inches apart. So the whole bed was just stuffed. And by cutting one leaf per head each day, 12 months later, I had all that filled with the same lettuce I started with. And that started me teaching people that, hold on a second, don't pull the whole head of lettuce out of the ground. Just cut the outer leaves. It'll grow back. Give it good nourishment. Reboost your soil. Give it light. In the wintertime, I put a lid on it. I put a 100-watt light bulb in there, and there could be 3 foot of snow on the ground. You go out, you lift that in, and you put your hand down there. Whether it was parsley or arugula, it was warm to the touch. Inexpensive, easy way to create simplistic insulation to grow food, at least for a family. And so everything was just laid out. There was at least 40 different types of apples in the apples trees. And then there were pears of all types. And then she would make pear cider, apple butter, apple sauce, dried apples. In fact, at one point, there must have been 200 kegs of different dried everything, dried string beans, dried tomatoes. Nothing ever went to waste. And that's how I learned organic farming. She ran this whole homestead with her and one of the Uncle Johnny, one of her, one of the young people who stayed with her, her son. But no one else cared about any of this. All they cared about was, you know, having their food somehow magically appear on their plate. And they all ate a lot of meat. But you would have bacon and eggs for breakfast, or sometimes what was called Canadian sausage. It was just the same cut, except it was cut differently. It looked like a hamburger patty. And you generally had two eggs, sausage, 2 to 4 pieces of sausage, cup of coffee with sugar. That was the average person's breakfast. Mine was always oatmeal with almonds or walnuts and some raw honey and cinnamon and fresh cream, because we had the milkmen deliver the milk and in the little milk carton in the morning. And the rich cream, since it was not homogenized, it was pasteurized, not homogenized, would be on top. It's always delicious. And so that was how you grew up. Today we realize that so many of the diseases that we suffered from was because of the bologna sandwiches at lunch. Everybody I knew had bologna sandwiches. You'd put some mustard on the bologna and white bread, and that was it. And then a big steak in the evening. You couldn't have a little steak. And you didn't want to have anything like oxtail because that was considered a poor person's cut of meat. And you wanted the big steak or the roast beef. And so that's what everyone ate. Everyone ate that where I grew up. Little wonder then that colorectal cancer, prostate cancer, breast cancer, stomach cancer became the norm. Now, on top of that, after the meal, everybody would smoke cigarettes and drink more coffee with more sugar. Trouble is nobody exercised. I mean, nobody. So it was normal to gain weight. and hence diabetes was considered just inevitable. And back then, it was where I grew up, it was called sugar diabetes because of the sugar that spilled over into the urine. Then you looked at the grams of protein consumed, and I actually did this. I went through my family's diet and found that they were consuming 300% more protein than what their body actually could use. And hence the reason why we had so much liver and kidney disease. And today, it's twice as bad. Because today, in order to compete, restaurants have to offer what is called differentiations. And one of the differentiations is give people a 2-pound steak. Give them, you know, a 4 patties. Give them eggs and cheese and bacon on a hamburger. You've all seen the ads. All of that causes cancer. All of that is highly allergenic. All that destroys DNA. It's just how long it will take before your body systems break down to a point where you're actually going to manifest a symptom. But between manifesting a symptom and the actual carnage that's going on in your body could take years, decades. So finally, Harvard Medical School shows us, give up the meat, all of it, and add up to 20% more to your lifespan. I'm sure that you've all heard about how sweating helps eliminate toxins. Indeed, the skin is the largest eliminatory organ in the body, and it is an organ. It's big. If you stretch out your skin and you look at all the capillaries and sweat glands, and what we now know is that this remarkable capacity to get toxins out of the body by regulating body temperature, meaning sweating, facilitates the elimination of all those accumulated heavy metals, lead, cadmium, mercury, petrochemicals. And that is healthy. That we should do. There is a new study published in the Archives of Environmental and Contamination Toxicology that looked at the bioaccumulated toxic elements within the human body and how we get rid of them. Quote from Sergey Grimedinfo from the study. Toxic elements are found in differing degrees in each of the blood, urine, and sweat in the body. Serum levels for most metals and metalloids were comparable with those found in other studies in the scientific literature. Many toxic elements appeared to be preferentially excreted through sweat, presumably stored in tissues. Some toxic elements readily identified in the perspiration of some participants were not found in their serum. Inducing sweating appears to be a potential method for elimination of many toxic elements from the human body. End quote. So in lay language, what does this study about sweating show? Well, it shows that cadmium goes out of the body through sweat, lead out of the body, arsenic out of the body, mercury out of the body. Now, how's the best way of sweating? For most people, I would suggest they do it through exercise. Right now is a good time of the year to get out, to get the sun, and a good 1-hour workout. You're going to perspire. Now, if you take vitamin C, quercetin, and reduced glutathione, alpha-lipoic acid, grapeseed extract, and glutamine, you will not only facilitate detoxification, but you will trap free radicals that are caused by the exercise, what are called the prooxidants, and you neutralize them, and then you get the benefit of the antioxidant effect, and you actually stimulate greater glutathione in the body to help you. So that sweat is terrific for you. So enjoy your sweating, your cleansing, and healing in the process. Now, I mentioned glutathione, and Sleuth Journal did a little interesting piece I read on the plane. Most people in this audience know that glutathione is your most important single nutrient of this endogenous molecule, meaning that originates in your liver and your cells, and it is your detoxifying nutrient. Glutathione is a natural antioxidant. Its primary job is to boost and support your immune system. Now, glutathione is made up of glycine, glutamate, and cysteine. It's in every single cell of your body. And it removes toxins and heavy metals and free radicals. And that's why, even in the brain is particularly susceptible to free radicals. And that can cause amyloid plaque, which leads to Alzheimer's and memory loss and dementia. So one of the primary nutrients I have everyone take when I'm trying to rejuvenate and detox is glutathione every day. So make sure that you're getting your glutathione, and there's a lot of science on it. In fact, glutathione is your number one nutrient for supporting your immune system, and doctors worldwide share over 100,000 articles supporting its benefits on PubMed.gov. And look at all the different experimental studies. Glutathione is just one of the most studied nutrients in history for cardiovascular disorders. The endothelial cells that line our blood vessels are critical to the proper function of your cardiovascular system. These cells are extremely vulnerable to oxidative stress. And according to the European Journal of Biochemistry, in an article entitled Glutathione, Oxidative Stress, Neurodegeneration, quote, there is a significant evidence that the pathogenesis of several neurodegenerative diseases, including Parkinson's, Alzheimer's, and ALS, may involve the generation of reactive oxygen species and mitochondrial dysfunction. Here we review the evidence for disturbance of glutathione homeostasis that may either lead to or result from oxidative stress neurodegenerative disorders. End quote. What it means is the more glutathione you have, the greater protection of your brain, your liver, your heart, your lungs. So let's make sure we're getting our reduced glutathione. And finally, this is an article on sleep. This is from University Hospital Case Medical Center in Cleveland, and from a Dr. Alma Barron, and it says, sleep-deprived women show signs of prematurely aged skin and a decrease in their skin's ability to recover after sun exposure. Quote, our study is the first to conclusively demonstrate that inadequate sleep is correlated with reduced skin health and accelerates skin's aging. With chronic sleep deprivation, we have linked other medical problems, including obesity, diabetes, cancer, and immune deficiency. But this one was about skin. So if you want to have older-looking skin, just stay up too late and don't get a good night's sleep, and you end up with prematurely aged skin. Something else on a good level here, from Concordia University in Montreal. Optimists are better at regulating stress. Relationships between optimism and stress hormone cortisol further define this relationship. And that's good. Because people who are positive are constantly reinforcing positive solutions. People who want to be positive but are stuck in conditioned negative behavior will go out of their way to look for anything, any word, any gesture, anything at all to justify staying negative. And as a result, that's why people continue to recycle negative behavior ad nauseum. They just can't break that cycle. And that's because they're looking for negative association. So when they have a negative association, they then say, ah, you see, I'm justified in thinking that that all Irish, you know, are drunks. Well, no. Why would you think that? Because at some point in their life, there was some association between a single drunk person and their Irish background. Well, fine. You could say that about everything. You could find the bad politician. You could find the corrupt lawyer. You could find the bad school teacher. That doesn't then make the entire system or everyone associated with it wrong. An optimist would try to look for that which is constructive within a lesson. The pessimist is looking for that which justifies their pessimism and lack of trust. And therefore, they're always mentally baiting you. They're always asking you to prove to them your love, your loyalty. And no human being can be that way all the time. So sooner or later, you're going to say something or do something that falls within this person's emotional minefield, and then they overreact. And then they go right through the same patterns of blame, same conditions. And that's because they can't regulate their stress. They're not optimists. They're pessimists in their actuality. So just remember, when you're around people who are always starting off, but, you all know those people. They walk around with their lower lip on the floor, tripping over it, and looking for some way to justify feeling bad. These people lack respect for the moment. They never look at how joyful life can be when you're given any gift in any moment. The gift of a sunny day, the gift of a beautiful rainstorm that you can sit and listen to, the gift of a kind word, the gift of a delicious tasting piece of fruit. They'll argue, but I wanted cherries, I didn't want peaches. They'll always find a way to justify their pessimism. And they, in their mind, will believe they're right. Because every time they think that, those thoughts go to the hippocampus part of the brain, and that's where then the emoting starts. So they take something outside, they attach it to their emotions, and then in their mind, they're justified in their anger, their sense of, woe is me. You know, you're a victim today. Why? Of course I'm a victim today. Well, it's because of how you think. So remember this. Stay optimistic, even under the worst of circumstances. Look for the meaning in all lessons, even those that are devastating. If I had a home at the beach, as one of our listeners did, and if I know that global warming is causing the oceans to rise faster than any mathematical model predicted, and if I know that a storm could be worse than what it had been in the past, the optimist will say, let me take this information and see if there's a better place for me to live where I can have beautiful aesthetics, maybe not on the ocean, maybe of a lake, maybe of a desert, someplace else. The pessimists say, I'm not going to move. I live here. It's my home. You know, it hasn't, you know, we haven't had a problem. So now you're just trying to scare us. True story. 5 months ago, I came downstairs from my office, come into the show, and there was a gentleman there. And he came over, he said, I wanted to tell you something. I have a piece of land that my family's had for a long time out in Long Island. It's right on the ocean. And my father lived there, and when he passed, it came to me as executive of our estate for all my brothers and sisters what to do with it. And they all wanted to keep it and move into the two houses there. And I had heard your shows on the 12 tipping points, and I'd also heard your warnings that we're due for higher velocity storms. And I'm thinking, on the one hand, I have my family that wants to stay there, doesn't want to leave, and I'm thinking, what if there is a bad storm? And at the last moment, going against everything my family wanted to do, I said, we're going to sell the property and you all get equal amounts of the money. And it was a good amount of money. And they were all angry with me. And 2 weeks after the closing on the sale, Hurricane Sandy hit. And about 6 hours into it, both of the homes were in the ocean. The property destroyed. The trees uprooted. Totally devastated. He said, so I thought, my goodness, there is a consequence to thinking about what you can do when you need to change. And yet not one of my siblings called and said, you were right. Because had I listened to them, we would have had nothing. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. Welcome, all of you. I realize people listen in different ways. Some of you listen over the internet. 99% of the people listening are listening generally after work and downloading the program from our archives. Some people listen live on the telephone, and you can do that anywhere in North America, including Canada, which is part of North America, by dialing 619-550-0869. 619-550-0869. From our environmental segment today, before we go to our guest, this is from Seattle, Washington, from the news service, Hannah Hickey. Nighttime heat waves quadruple in Pacific Northwest. Nighttime heat waves are becoming more frequent in western Washington and Oregon. And if you don't sleep well in hot weather, this might be a good time to buy a fan, since records show that on average, heat waves tend to strike around this time of year. University of Washington research shows that the region west of the Cascades saw, and it goes into this enormous amount of what happens at night. Well, what happens at night, it's the humidity from all that water out there is trapping the heat. And so people are finding that temperature is not really dropping from the daytime. It's getting really hot at night. And now they're saying that's the new norm. That said, I want to share insights from Sasha Bromsky and from my own input, since I've lived in the Southwest. I've had homes in the Southwest, in West Texas. I've interviewed hundreds of people in my recent documentaries, just returned from major filming. By the way, my next film will premiere in New York in September. More on that to come. Ed Moore's ranch sits on the flatlands of the Texas Panhandle east of Lubbock, just outside the tiny town of Rawls. On a clear day, you can see for miles in any direction. Most days, however, the dust blows, and when it does, the sky becomes a dull orange haze, and the scene becomes impressionistic. The high gray towers of grain elevators dot the landscape. Cattle graze in silhouette. Farmers ride through the gloom on tractors with vast sand fighters that gather the earth into big clogs so the soil won't blow away. It's daytime, yet it's dark. Not as black as it gets during the worst of the dust storms, like those that tore through southeastern Colorado in the spring and the ones that swept across Phoenix a few years ago. And maybe not as bleak as the land-destroying Dust Bowl days in the 1930s, but nevertheless, eerily subdued. Something clearly is not right. In a typical year, the winds ease up in mid-spring and the dust tamps down. In the past 3 years, however, as the rains have failed and the land has dried up, the winds have continued into the searingly hot summers. As they blow, the soil disintegrates, and what little moisture there is in the earth evaporates. The soil quality is now so poor, on the few occasions when it does rain, the next day's wind simply blows the newly moistened topsoil away. Across the air, you can see rows of cotton, black and dead in the orange earth. Entire fields burned by the static electricity generated by the sandstorms. Locals have started calling the storms by their Arabic name, Haboobs, presumably a nomenclature brought back by returning Iraq vets. Lately, the Haboobs have been visiting themselves on the high plains with a depressing regularity. They are no longer considered an episodic menace, but rather a fixture on the landscape, the calling card of an emerging climatological disaster. Moore, who was born in a farmhouse on his family's land just north of Rawls, is 73 years old. His balding head is deeply tan, his forearms mottled by the sun and wind. When he was a young man, he got an engineering degree and headed to Seattle to work for Boeing. In 1971, his heart called him back to West Texas. It was, after all, the land to which his mother and father had trekked in a covered wagon in the 1920s. He recalled being told that his mother, at age 5, had walked alongside the wagon all the way from Comanche, Texas, 250 miles away. They were lured to the region by the promise of cheap, fertile land, the promise that drew so many to the high plains during the boom years that preceding the catastrophic onset of the Dust Bowl. "This land, I loved it," says the old farmer softly, his eyes staring far off in the distance. It means essentially the world to me. I want to make sure I take care of it and make sure my sons can have it. The only thing we worry about is the water supply. Last summer, the water table in Moore's area dropped by about a foot. The White River Reservoir, which supplies water to four towns in the area, is at its lowest point since it was built in the 1960s, about 10 feet at its deepest. It's just pollywog water. His two wells, which used to pump up 500 gallons per minute, are putting out just 150 gallons per minute. Like the Hubbabs, water scarcity here is starting to seem like something other than a passing concern. It's a troubling sign of a long-term trend, a problem exacerbated by drought, but more complex than annual precipitation. After decades of overuse, tapping into aquifers and removing more water than nature could add back, even during the abnormally wet 1980s and 90s, the water credit system in this part of the country seems to be running out. He says, we've used up much more water in the last couple of years than we normally would because of the drought. Moore largely uses a dry land farming technique since there isn't enough water to irrigate his fields. If it rains, he can grow crops and keep cattle. If it doesn't, he can't. I like a challenge. Every day is different. That's what farming is. Do we plant cotton? Do we plant milo? Do we fight sand? When do we quit it all and get on a horse and ride? The question is not merely rhetorical, as Moore and his neighbors confront the grim possibility that this year's rains will again fall far short of the 25 inches he says are necessary, with dwindling underground reserves to draw from. They are simply facing the facts. We hope the rain starts up again. If they don't, this little town will disappear, and all others like it. A similar lament can be heard across the Southwest, in bone-dry communities in Texas, New Mexico, Oklahoma, and Kansas. Thanks to record drought and heat, Arizona and Colorado have been plagued by fierce forest fires in recent months. 19 elite forest fighters died in an Arizona blaze in late June. And it's not just rural areas under threat. Cities are also at risk. Las Cruces, New Mexico, has to drill wells 1,000 feet deep to extract water. Smaller municipalities in Magdalena, south of Albuquerque, are trucking in water. What we're seeing in these regions is a harbinger. Around the world, as climate change accelerates and population growth bumps up against natural limits, water access is becoming increasingly important and increasingly precarious. The economic impact is immediate and severe. Quote, right now, there ain't anything underneath that dry land, says Johnny Shepherd, who manages a cotton gin near Lubbock. In 2011, the drought was so extreme that 60% of the state's cotton crop was lost. According to the Department of Agriculture, the numbers have improved since then, but only marginally. More than 40% of the Texas cotton crop was lost last year. And given current conditions, the losses are likely to be similar this year. Nationally, cotton production declined from 18 million bales in 2010 to 17 2012, with much of that drop in the Southwest. As hay and alfalfa prices skyrocket in response to the drought, farmers are selling off animals they can no longer afford to feed. The cattle herd in Texas is down by more than 1 million. Nationally, the figure has declined from more than 98 million head a few years ago to about 89 today. The tight supply sets up the prospect that consumers will pay far more for beef in the years to come. In eastern New Mexico and Texas Panhandle, about 20% of the dairies have gone belly up for similar reasons. Milk production costs have risen 50%, a portion of which has been passed on to the consumer. Last year, the corn crop was about 25% shy of its potential. After years of heady expansion of genetically modified crops, U.S. corn production has dropped to its below 2000 level. And these days, much of the nation's corn crop is being used not for food, but for ethanol fuel. And because the U.S. food production anchors the international food system, a drought in exports leads to price inflation in countries where poor populations spend a larger percent of their income on staples. Markets overseas have also been hit by the U.S. drought-induced shipping disruptions. 60% of all grain exported through the Gulf of Mexico is shipped in ports via the Mississippi River. But for a few weeks late last year, the river levels around Thebes, Illinois, fell so low that barges filled with grain destined for export had to lighten their loads, much of the $7 billion in commodities that the American Waterways Operations and Waterway Council estimates normally traveled down the Mississippi, got backed up. Now, American agriculture is extraordinarily resilient, engineered with to withstand regional droughts and even prolonged national weather crisis. Even so, farmers who must adapt need time to familiarize themselves with new crops, and scientists need time to learn what grows best during years of extreme water scarcity. But with weather patterns shifting more rapidly and water resources drying up, time is not on their side. So I'm out there, I'm seeing this, and I'm telling you, in some communities, you could hire a person for $10 an hour that used to make $100, used to have their own family farms, because they didn't believe that water would run out, that the days would get hotter, and that they'd have Dust Bowl days again. Dust Bowl days are back. Last week it was in Phoenix. The entire sky, for miles, was one giant dust storm. That's the new norm. I'm Gary Knoll for our Environmental Report. Now let's go over and say hello to my guest who is standing by. He is Gary Leach, as I mentioned, is the director of the Center for International Studies and the Department of Political Science at Cape Breton University in Nova Scotia, Canada. And as an independent journalist and author, his research is focused upon the global struggle for social justice and on the U.S. intervention in Colombia under the War on Drugs and the War on Terror. He has published extensively on this, and in fact, he was one of the founding editors of the Columbia Journal with over 350 scholarly articles. He's written seven books. His most recent is Capitalism, a Structural Genocide, which takes an honest look at how contemporary capitalism's inherent and fundamental structure generates inequality and violence and increased human suffering and death. His website is Gary Leach, LEECH.com. Nice to have you with us today, Gary.
Thank you for having me, Gary.
Gary, I'm like a lot of people in this audience. I'm concerned when we think of the term genocide, we immediately think of the Nazis and the Holocaust, Pol Pot, Stalin, Pinochet, Mao, and other despotic national leaders who murdered tens of thousands and millions of their citizens. And that's usually how international laws perceive it. However, perhaps we need to broaden or redefine our understanding of the long-term genocide consequences in this age of globalization and the free reign of unregulated free trade capitalism on the global economy. Now, in your analysis, capitalism kills, quote, about 10 million people around the world annually. Therefore, since the time of Bill Clinton and Hillary Clinton's World Trade Organization agreements, like NAFTA and TRIPS, went into effect, and Obama now trying with the Trans-Pacific Partnership, we're looking at approximately 150 million victims from the capitalist system. 150 million. So first, based upon existing international laws, should we broaden our definition of genocide? And then second, you write about capitalism's, quote, structural violence that intentionally inflicts on any group or collectivity conditions of life that bring about its physical destruction in whole or in part. And then that capitalism's, quote, genocidal intent is implicit in the facts. It is not necessarily premeditated. So provide us with the rationale for how violence and genocide are then inherent in the very structure of capitalism's theory and practice.
As you mentioned, the idea of the book is to expand the definition of genocide. There has been an increase in recent years in scholars and legal experts to include structural violence. That means those people who are dying around the world due to these social structures that dominate in the globe, such as people who have lack of access to medicines because of the poverty they exist in, and that people who are dying from preventable and treatable diseases but can't access medicines because of the societal structures. And as you pointed out, when we talk of genocide, we think of those specific cases, the Nazis, Pol Pot, Stalin. And they're easy to identify the primary individuals responsible for the mass deaths in those cases. And the problem with the capitalist, the argument I'm making that capitalism constitutes a structural genocide, is I'm arguing it's not necessarily the people who are in charge of the capitalist system, whether it's economic elites or governments. It's the logic of the system itself, that it's in that structural violence is inherent in capitalism, and the structural violence results in death on such a scale, as you said, pointed out. I've claimed at least 10 million people a year die unnecessarily from capitalist structures. So therefore, the system itself is structurally genocidal. Now, my argument is that the logic of capitalism, it's an economic system that's rooted in profit-making. Its logic is to accumulate more capital, generate profits, accumulate more capital, and expand. Therefore, the logic of production in a capitalist society is to produce for profit, not produce for human need, whether people need housing, whether they have insufficient food, whether they have insufficient health care. That's not the driving logic. For example, in Europe, they spend $11 billion a year on ice cream. Now, that's $2 billion more than is required to provide safe drinking water and sanitation to everyone in the global south. But the logic of capital produces ice cream because people in Europe have the disposable income to purchase ice cream, so there's profit in that, whereas people in the global south don't have the money to purchase safe drinking water, so that is not a viable market. So as a result, we have a system that results in tens of millions every year dying as a result of these structures. And therefore, I would argue that the internal logic of capitalism is inherently genocidal.
Okay. Now I understand where you're coming from on that. Share with us the violent nature inherent in NAFTA and its consequences upon Mexicans.
Yeah, NAFTA is a great example of what's going on globally in microcosm, because the free trade doctrine that applies in NAFTA, as you mentioned the WTO earlier, is being applied globally in many parts of the world. Now, NAFTA, under NAFTA, the U.S. has flooded Mexico with agricultural exports. Now, in the United States, we massively subsidize our agribusinesses, so that these exports can now under NAFTA can flow into Mexico, and the small Mexican farmer can no longer produce and compete with the price that U.S. corn sells for in Mexico, and not just corn, but also wheat and rice and many other staples. And so therefore, they're put out of business. And again, this is the logic of the system. It serves the interests of capital, not the small farmer, the corporate capital. And so U.S. agribusinesses now dominate Mexico. The 430% more of the market is now dominated, Mexican market is now dominated by U.S. agribusiness corporations. Since in the first decade of NAFTA, more than 2 million Mexican farmers were forced out of farming. So they've lost their livelihoods. And the only reason they couldn't compete was because they're not subsidized to the degree that the U.S. agribusinesses are. Now, the logic of capital is that these now become a surplus labor force for the new manufacturing jobs. So in Detroit and everywhere else, we lose our decent paid manufacturing jobs, which now move to Mexico. And instead of paying an order worker $30 an hour, whatever they're earning, we can now pay $1.70 an hour in Mexico to assemble the cars and electronics and everything else. And these 2 million farmers who have been forced off their land now become the wage laborers for these new factories. The only problem is NAFTA, at its height in 2000, had created 700,000 manufacturing jobs, nowhere near enough to provide work for the 2 million displaced farmers. And moreover, by 2003, half of those 700,000 jobs had moved off again to China. So you've got this massive population that is desperate to find an economic means of subsistence. And it's no coincidence that The drug war, violence, and the drug trade has escalated in the era of NAFTA in Mexico, as the free trade, the amount of trade going across the border, has made it easy to smuggle cocaine. You've got desperately poor Mexicans, who are vulnerable and becoming engaged in the drug trade. And the other consequence has been the so-called immigration problem. In 1994, when NAFTA was implemented, there were only 4.8 million Mexican-born people in the United States. Within 5 years of NAFTA, that had almost doubled to 9 million, because as we displaced these 2 million farmers and they couldn't find jobs in Mexico, they did the next logical thing. Let's go across the border to the U.S. to find a way to survive. And now, after creating conditions that have ruined the livelihoods of millions of farmers, we now want to build a wall across the border to make sure that they don't come here to find a way to survive. And so, you know, these are all intrinsically linked. And the logic of the system is to create favorable conditions for corporate capital. And so our agribusinesses expand their markets, they create a cheap labor force at the same time they displace farmers in Mexico and other countries, and their profit ratios skyrocket, our stock market indexes skyrocket. This is what we've seen, corporate profits and stock market indexes going through the roof for the last 20, 30 years, on generally, the general trajectory. And corporations, investors have done really well. But for the average manufacturing worker in the United States and other countries, wealthy nations, those jobs have gone overseas. They're now working for $10 an hour in Walmart or call centers instead of in factories. And in Mexico and other countries in the global south, people who had subsistence lifestyles, who were poor by our standards, but once they've lose their access to land and they become unemployed and there's not enough jobs for them, now they become really poor, and many of them try to immigrate to countries like the United States, Canada, and Europe to find a way to survive.
When you throw in the international banks that provide us with an example of capitalism's genocidal structure and how they operate, and then the hedge funds and the equity partnerships, and then multinational corporations like Monsanto that create Terminator seeds that you can only plant once, and then go after anyone that tries to plant a seed twice. And yet historically, all the seeds that are grown in one season, a certain percentage are kept aside. If you grow tomatoes, you'll keep a certain amount of tomato seeds aside. That becomes your stock for the next year. And now they don't want that to happen. So now we see the footprint everywhere around the world of banks, governmental agencies, both their own and complicit with Washington, our State Department, backed up by our international intelligence agencies that are willing to use the full force and power of the United States military to get our products, our services, our banks, our profits out of their countries. Wouldn't you think that the mainstream media would see this and someone would report on this? And yet I haven't seen those stories.
No, exactly. This is, a lot of these issues are not touched on by the mainstream media, and then there's numerous reasons for that. I mean, one, most of the mainstream media are owned by corporations who have vested interest in the existing system. So rarely do you see the mainstream media challenging the fundamental structures of the existing global capitalist system. And the other reason, of course, is that our media, our so-called professional media, journalists, are overly dependent on official sources. So whenever anything happens anywhere in the world or with the economy, the first place they run to is the government, to get the government spokesperson. And in order to be quote-unquote objective, they get a Democrat's perspective, they get a Republican's perspective, and there you go, we've covered both sides. When essentially, the Democrats and Republicans both advocate and support the existing free market capitalist model. So alternative views get marginalized. And the case you were talking, and the examples you were giving around Terminator seeds with Monsanto and Cargo and these other companies, they've proved devastating for peasants around the world, farmers around the world, Latin America, Africa, Asia. For example, in India, and one of the case studies in my book, I look at India, and India has had its markets pried open and has been forced to accept Terminator seeds, patented seeds in cotton, in other food seeds. And what happens is these farmers then get convinced to purchase the seeds, and along with them the chemical pesticides and fertilizers required by those seeds. And they have to borrow money to purchase them. And they've been told that your yields will increase to such a degree that paying off those loans will be no problem and you'll be better off. Whereas before, they used to engage in, as you pointed out, seed saving. Seeds were viewed as a commons, that everyone owned them. And you'd save them and you'd plant them next year. But these new seeds, as you said, terminated seeds, they're good for one season. The plants grow. They don't produce new seeds that can be replanted. So the yields have not been what the Monsantos of the world said they would be. So in India, for example, now you've got tens of thousands of farmers who are in debt, and they have no choice but to borrow more money to buy new seeds to try and earn more money again each year, this spiral, to earn money to keep paying, trying to pay off the debts as best they can. They can't go back to the old subsistence farming because these chemicals have poisoned the earth. It takes 3 to 5 years for soil to regenerate after it's been dosed with chemicals like that. So they have to have these chemicals to grow crops. And they need a cash crop for export to pay off their loans. And so this has become such a crisis in India now that many Indian farmers are so buried in debt that they've started committing suicide, many by drinking the pesticides from Monsanto and the corporations.
More than 280,000, according to Dr. Vandana Shiva.
Exactly. Over
a quarter million people died. We're out of time. Thank you very much, Gary Leach, for coming on. Is Capitalism a Structural Genocide? The website is Gary, G-A-R-R-Y, Leach, L-E-E-C-H.com. All the best to you.
Thank you, Guy.
I'm Gary Null. We're out of time. I want to thank you all for listening. Now, in studio in our New York, back in the city, is Luann Panessi. Hi, Luann.
Hello, Gary. I am getting a lot of phone calls of people interested in coming to your upcoming retreat in August. Very exciting. Lots of people. And if essentially people are saying, what I'm looking for is something that I can, a place where I can go to learn how to integrate all of the amazing things that I'm learning on Gary's show, a place where I can learn how to actually meditate or do yoga, a place where I can learn how to relax, a place where I can learn about food. Most people think that having a vegan lifestyle is hard. It's overwhelming. I don't know where to start. I don't know what arugula is. So they're asking me questions like, is this a kind of place where I can actually learn about healthy eating and take it home with me so that I can integrate it at home? And the answer is yes. You've got it all here. Sustainability, you're in a beautiful, bucolic environment, and people are very excited. A lot of people signing up. So if people do want to contact me,
yes,
they can contact me at my home office. That number is 631-504-6198. That's 631-504-6198. And some people have been emailing me, WHNN, like Nancy, at AOL.com. WHNN at AOL.com.
This new retreat is in support of WPFW, our sister station, where I've been on for 30 years. I'm on there 5 days a week, 3 to 4 every afternoon. It's to help the station and help its audience. Now, we just finished helping KPFK, where I've also been on for 30 years, 6 hours a week, and it was magnificent. First, here's what is reasonable. People are going to learn about sustainability. What are the best places in the future to live? Where to live? How do you support yourself? How do you get off the grid? For those people who are in stressful situations, I'm stuck. I don't know what to do. I don't have the resources. I have the resource. I don't have the courage. I have the courage, but I don't know what to do. All these different variables. How do I go from where I'm at in my life to the next place in my life? How can I close one chapter without being traumatic and begin a new chapter?
Exactly.
And whether it's learning how to cook, people will. Garden, they are. Hydroponics, it's there. Yoga, meditation, personal training, getting into good shape, getting your health back, your mental health, your physical health, being able to meditate with nature in one of the most pristine, pure environments in America. Being able to be counseled. You're going to be giving personal counseling with people, as you did. And I also give a lecture every night. I'm giving impromptu lectures two or three times a day.
Do you know, people keep asking me, is Gary Noel going to really be there? Is he really going to be, like, physically there? I said, physically. Yes.
I mean, I'm everywhere. Everywhere I'm going, you know, even why silence during meals. I did a whole hour lecture during a meal to explain what goes on in the body when you're diverting your attention from the food and how to put your energy in the right place. The energy work we did. I mean, people are still writing me about what happened. They still don't understand it, but something good happened. They just don't understand it. The meditation classes every day. Lots of time for journal writing, introspection, quiet time, peace. 1 week, August 18th for 1 week. Again, I'm donating my time as a public service. You're donating your time as a public service. But the people are going to come. It's $2,000 for the week. We looked at over 100 places around the world that offer something similar, and it averaged over $7,000 for the week per person. So here's the deal. We can only take 20 to 30 people. That's all. I like to keep it small so everyone gets attention. And so if you want to be one of those people who can change your life, start over. And we had couples, we had singles. It was a wonderful experience. And we're now getting those photos, at least from one of the three photographers. The others will come in the next couple of days up on ProgressiveRadarNetwork.com, so you can actually see how beautiful the environment was and some of the things they were doing. Yoga with laughter. Now, that's rare, right? Normally, yoga teachers are, you know, not happy people. These were happy times. Meditation the same way. John Q working out on the road. You see these beautiful sunrises, sunsets. So it's a special time. I believe people don't realize when opportunity comes, take it. Because if you don't, one day you're going to think, I should have gone, I should have gotten, I need it now, and I don't have the tools I need. Because like it or not, we're in a perfect storm. Financial storm, ecological storm, and personal health storm. We need resolution. We need a way of getting from where we're at to where we need to be. We got to get out of our comfort zone. If you stay in your comfort zone, you're going to be the frog in the water that doesn't realize the water's boiling. So call Luann, and what's your number, Luann?
631-504-6198.
Okay, thank you. I'm Gary Noel. We're out of time. Let's go over and say hello now to our good friend standing by 5 days a week, Utrece Lead. Hi, Utrece.
Hello, Gary. Today we are talking about the March on Washington, which becomes 50 years old next month. We're practically on the cusp of it. But we are talking about the purpose of the march was for jobs and freedom, and our guest will be talking about the first part, which is the jobs part.
Good. And
how much progress has been made since then?
Excellent. Tomorrow I'm going to be doing a commentary where I took President Obama's speech yesterday, and I've deconstructed and shown that not one single thing that he said was accurate. Every single thing he said, I will repeat verbatim, end quote, and then I'll show you the truth of that tomorrow. So much for great rhetoric, no results. But we've seen that so many times from so many people in positions of power. Right now, Utrece Lead, who, by the way, now has a larger audience on the Progressive Radio Network than she ever had in her 20 years on the air at WBAI, holding forth on her afternoon talkback segment that's now handled by Hugh Hamilton. Utrece is coming at you right now.
Thank you, Gary.